just to ease my mind.
And it is at about that moment where everything would go loud and crazy, but obviously the monotone voice says that it's Robert instead of Frank.
Apparently, yeah.
Apparently. So, anyway, it's Robert from Fish and Frank's. Got RJ back in the studio under control, theoretically.
Theoretically.
And then we've got, once again, our special guest, Josh Olive, who's a man of 27 different hats.
Now, would you like me to monotone like you, or would you like me to Fish and Frank it today?
Okay. Sure.
Sure, yeah, whatever.
I don't think you can maintain that for an hour, but I'm not going to even try to attend.
I probably can't.
No. But no.
I could give it a shot.
Yeah, we could.
An interesting challenge.
No, I think we should just talk about fishing stuff.
When I collapse in 15 minutes, then you're going to have to do the show on your own, and that's no good.
Yeah, I got RJ. He's got good backup.
Right. I was just thinking, you know, if you've been watching TV lately, we're in the middle of a world-ending pandemic. The oceans are boiling. The economy is about to crash. And if you haven't been watching TV, it's Thursday and it's the Fish and Frank show.
Nice. I like it.
What kind of morons are still watching TV?
I have no idea.
I don't get it.
No. I watch the first 10 minutes of it in the morning to kind of catch the local stuff and the inaccurate weather for the most part.
You know what I watched this morning?
Nothing.
I watched the rain falling out of the sky, landing on the grass, butterflies flitting around in it, dragonflies attacking mosquitoes, birds going after the dragonflies, and that was a much better time than I could possibly have had with the news.
This is true. This is very true. But sometimes you still have to watch the news a little bit, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. So was it Mark Twain that said it? If you don't read the news, you're uninformed, but if you read the news, you're misinformed?
Yes, there you go.
I think that's how it went. Pretty sure it was Mark Twain. Come on, scholars over here. You're supposed to help me out with that part.
Yeah, we'll go with that, Robert. We'll make it look good. So.
All those Mark Twain quotes were made up in 1995.
I know. So. Sounds good in theory, though.
Yeah.
But either way, fishing out there is going to be a little screwy for the next couple of days, I'm going to say, because of all the rain that we've had. Because it wasn't just here. I mean, it rained from north of Tampa to, Naples yesterday all day.
All up and down.
And some of it was like impressive downpours of rain.
I was in Gainesville two weekends in a row prior to this, and it rained every day.
Right.
And it rained hard. It wasn't just misty stuff. So there's a lot of water coming down through central Florida.
Right.
Now, I did read that they removed the last 6 or 8 miles of the old Tamiami Trail around the Everglades.
Yes.
To open up the water flow there again. So I think that's going to help.
That'll be interesting to see what it actually does or doesn't.
Well, you know, they're kind of hoping that it's going to slow down the algae production in a lot of the canals in the Chattahoochee River and a few other places. So we'll wait and see what happens.
Chattahoochee or Caloosahatchee?
Caloosahatchee, that's what I meant. Yeah.
Chattahoochee's in Georgia.
Yeah.
So.
Right. I think if they stop spraying the hyacinth and the hydrilla and to all those lakes, it'll actually help a lot with a lot of the pollutants, personally.
You know, there's just so much stuff going into the rivers right now, especially with all of this rain.
I mean, right.
Every drop of fertilizer that you've put on your lawn is in the Gulf now, so.
Exactly.
I worry less about that than all the sewage leak stuff.
Well, yeah. I mean, City of Venice, have you guys fixed that problem yet? It's only about 20 years old.
Yeah, only. But we've built several thousand more homes there.
Yep, and we're going to build a whole lot more.
Yeah.
And the solution to the runoff problem was to put more people on sewer as opposed to septic with an antiquated septic system treatment plant that can't handle what it's got, and it's putting 10-15%, I think, is their maximum overflow that they're allowed to do. Consistently.
Nice.
Every day, 10-15% untreated sewage.
But it's no big deal. It's fine.
It's fine. It'll be fine.
What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah, what's the worst that can happen? And then we have Piney Point. And oh, gee, that's not going to be a problem. You know, don't worry about it. It's just basically particulate matter. And we're seeing one of the worst fish kills that we've seen in a long time.
Yeah, well, and they say that about every other red tide event, it seems like.
I think this is less of a red – well, it is a red tide event. I don't want to say it's not. It is. But I think you've got a lot more going on from what was in those storage ponds that are now out in the Gulf and in the bay and in the currents and everything else. And I think there's a lot more toxins out there than just the red tide toxins.
Well, there's two things that are toxic that you find in those ponds in the Piney Point area, basically the phosphate waste. Because most of the silt had settled out of them, you don't have the silt itself. The silt is a huge problem. The silt is what killed the Peace River twice when it turned it into what looked like very pale chocolate milk. So that's a huge factor that we're not dealing with in Piney Point. So that leaves us with two things. It leaves us with nutrient pollution and a high acidity level. So the high acidity level pretty much gets diluted as soon as it starts hitting the salt water. It's going to kill things in that immediate area, but it's not going to kill too many things beyond that because, I mean, take an acid and pour it into water and it becomes dilute pretty quick. You're not killing things with it anymore. Take a cup full of vinegar and put your guppies in it and watch them die immediately. Now take that same cup full of vinegar and dump it into a 120-gallon fish tank and see what effect it has. It really doesn't. It lowers the pH a tiny bit, but not enough to be a problem. So that's a problem in the immediate area and when you immediately have the dumping going on that has been since ameliorated. It's not a problem anymore. But you do have that nutrient pollution, which hangs out and which stays and which gets moved around by currents, and that's the bigger problem. But there's really no other poisons in there that we could find out about. I mean, there's a little bit of heavy metal waste in it, in the particulate matter like you were talking about, but not really enough for it to cause a serious problem. So, you know, I honestly think Piney Point is less of an issue than a lot of other people think is, because we didn't see, I mean, we saw localized fish kill happening. We saw nasty water happening up in Tampa Bay immediately after that Piney Point discharge, but it's been months now. And we didn't really see this major red tide fish kill event happen until Tropical Storm Elsa went by and brought all that rain and flushed all that other stuff, all the other land-based stuff, all that raw sewage out into our waterways. That's when we had our problem. So Piney Point, to me, it seems like it's easy to point a finger, but I don't think that that's really the issue that we're dealing with here.
Well, that's with any red tide event. I mean, it's never just one thing. I think it's a whole bunch of little pieces coming together that make it flourish.
Right. But you know, the big problem to me is that, you know, when we talk about red tides and we talk about the causes and try to come up with solutions, we always want to point to somebody else.
Sure.
It's their fault. It's not my fault. It's your fault. It's what you do. You're the one who fertilized your lawn. You live right on a canal.
No,
Robert.
It's your fault.
You live right on a canal. Your dogs used to poop in your yard. And
I'm on sewer. You're on septic.
Out. Well, it's RJ's fault. RJ lives in an area where there's a lot of sand, and his septic gets flushed right down into there and goes right out into the Gulf of Mexico. It's him.
See, this is all politics all over again.
Exactly. Because I refuse to admit my responsibility. But I have responsibility, and I know that I do.
Right.
Every one of us does.
Absolutely. That's what I told my uncle yesterday. I said, just build an ark because that's what it's going to take. It's just going to take a major event and wipe out a lot of the population in order to fix most of these problems.
Yeah.
That's basically what it boils down to, because it's not just one event. It's all of it adding up, and people don't realize red tide's a natural occurrence. It happens all the time over centuries.
Yes.
But isn't that the big excuse? Oh, well, red tide is naturally occurring.
Yes.
You got to add the second part of it. It's naturally occurring when it's faced with and given the fuel it needs to grow. And then if you turn around and say, oh, wait a minute, we're giving it all kinds of fuel this year, there's your problem. Not that, oh, it's just naturally occurring.
Yeah, it's naturally occurring, but should be relatively uncommon.
That's right.
It's not naturally occurring and should happen every 6 months. That's not the way it should be.
No, and also it shouldn't be happening on the grand scale that it's happening at. It should be more localized, but that's not what's going on. We're seeing it all over.
Right.
And I guess, again, I don't understand the mechanism. Josh has got that much better than me, but we're seeing big fish Goliath grouper washing up here in the local area.
Yeah, but the Goliath grouper, that's an easy answer for them. You know, they're lazy, and they're very much like a homebody. They don't want to leave their structure, their home, versus all of your other fish pretty much want to run away from it because they don't have a dock that they like the most where they want to stay for security reasons. Snook, they'll run down the beach. They'll run back into the intercoastal. They don't run up underneath a dock and try to hide from something like that the way a Goliath grouper does.
Yeah, let's go out to the reef, RJ. You and me, we're going to go fishing, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to hook a kingfish out there at the reef. What's the kingfish going to do when he's hooked?
He's going to take off.
Right. He's going to book it. He's going to run. He's going to run away from the problem. You're going to hook a grouper. What's he going to do?
Right back to the bottom again to his hidey hole.
Exactly. And that's how they respond to those problems. So when they have that red tide problem, when things start to get weird, you have very different responses from different species. And the species that respond by staying put tend to be the ones that die.
That's one of the biggest things. You know, up in Tampa, I mean, they've had tons of sea turtles. They've had dolphin, like flipper dolphin dying. You know, manatees, obviously, all that good stuff. But not good stuff and good, but you know right. What I mean. But your fish species, you look at it, it's always kind of the same species over and over again that get hammered. And usually when it's like the reason why we're talking about this today is because we actually got red tide from Manasota Key all the way down through Boca Grande, and it just went into the Boca Grande Bayou, which is the canal systems of Boca Grande. And we're seeing a pretty good snook kill in there. And that's because those fish got surrounded by it because it came in through Gasparilla Pass and Boca Grande Pass and basically closed the doors on both sides of that canal and blocked those fish in. And that's why you see some of those big fish kills like that of snook.
Yeah, when you're flanked on both sides, you don't really have any place to run. And that'll happen to some fish. I mean, we saw tarpon killed by red tide last year up here in Charlotte Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
You see occasionally big sharks get killed by red tide, but when you see that, it reminds you that, hey, this isn't what we usually see. Wow, look at what it killed this time.
Right.
Whereas usually, you know, we expect to see reef fish. We expect to see some little bait fish that are kind of slow pokes and don't have the speed to get out of the way. It's stuff that gets surrounded, you know.
Right.
We've had mullet that get killed by it because sometimes the timing is just bad. We had a red tide in 2011 that killed a bunch of big breeder redfish, not because they couldn't get away from it, but because it happened while they were spawning.
Right.
And biology dictates, hey, to spawn, we got to go in the pass. And
right.
That's where the red tide is.
Yeah. We got to go through that area to go offshore, and they went right through it to get to the other side and didn't quite make it.
And it nails mullet in the fall for the same reason.
Yeah.
Although some of those all mullet red tide fish kills don't have anything to do with red tide.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's red. It's not that they didn't have any red in them. That's
right.
Why they
there
died.
There was no red roe. They were just full of white roe. It's amazing when you see those red tides that kill only male mullet.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. You've seen that, right?
Must be some kind of natural selection.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, we got to bring this up because it sucks because it's doom and gloom. But red tide is here, unfortunately, in the lower, basically the intercoastal and out along the beaches.
Right. But let's be real clear about that, okay? When we say red tide's here, listen to the second part too, okay? Intercoastal area, out along the beaches. If you live on a canal in Punta Gorda, if you live on the Myakka River in Northport, you're not dealing with red tide.
Not at all.
You might have water that smells a little bit funky. You might see a couple of dead fish because fish die. You do not have red tide.
Right. Yeah, and the funky smell is a combination of actually a lot of things. It's summertime, extremely hot water. All that vegetation and basically organic materials that are on the bottom of your canals are decomposing at a much faster rate and create methane gas and everything else. And that methane gas escapes and bubbles up every now and then, or because you've got all the little freshwater canals and ditches and swales and everything else are dumping so much fresh water into these canals, it's creating a big turnover rate because it's changing some of the currents and disturbing that bottom and stirring some of that bottom to come up to the top that's going to have that nasty smell.
Yeah, and we saw some of that in the Manchester waterway last week where it had a nasty sulfurous odor and there was a scum on the surface. Mm-hmm. And the people I'm like with, look, it's red tide. I said, no, it ain't red tide.
Yeah, just a natural thing that happens with anything that dies off and gets back into the water system.
So how does all this fresh water affect the red tide? I know initially it seems like it helps to create more and more red tide because you're flushing nutrients out into the waterways. But at some point, doesn't the fresh water kill red tide?
Yeah, fresh water and red tide do not mix at all. Red tide can't live in low salinity conditions when your water gets down to about half of seawater strength. It's going to kill it. It's not going to be able to survive. When it gets down to about two-thirds of seawater strength, you start seeing the red tide. If you looked at the individual red tide organisms under a microscope, you would see they're not doing very well. They're not swimming properly. They're kind of on their way out. But that's also got two edges to it, because if you have an area where you have red tide organisms and you dump a bunch of fresh water in there and it's enough to kill them, when they die, they release all the brevetoxin that's in their bodies. So you can get this sudden super toxic water where all that red tide is dying off. And that can cause major fish kills too.
That's awesome.
Isn't it though?
No. But so, a lot of people don't think about that, because as it dies off, it's, you know, like anything else, it's releasing it out of its system. It's kind of like the same way when we keep sharks, you know.
Right, and they dump all that urea.
Yeah, they dump all that urea through their skin and into their meat, and that's why they taste horrible. You know, if it was still alive and swimming, it wouldn't stall that stuff out. It would just keep it through its system. Kind of the same concept.
Yeah.
Different, but same concept.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of that is what leads to the dead air-breathing animals that we see, the sea turtles, the manatees, the dolphins. I think those animals sometimes are in those areas where you have that strong freshwater outflow and you get all that brevetoxin released all at once. Because remember, those animals have to breathe right at the surface of the water.
Yeah, they're literally at water level.
They've got no choice. You know, they can't, you know, go up 15 feet into the air and get a breath where it's nice and clean up there. They've got to pick it up right there. And that wave action, too, lyses a lot of that stuff out. You get that heavy wave action and you get aerosolized brevetoxins that are right there at water level. So if those animals aren't successfully able to get out of that area and quickly, because they got to breathe, then you end up with deaths like that.
Yeah. Or it's a long death because it's harmed them enough where they become pretty weak.
Right. Ocean COVID.
Yeah. Nice.
Ocean COVID, yeah.
Nice. That's terrifying. So on the flip side of good things that are happening out there, you know, the tarpon have been going pretty darn good the last several days. And I think some of this fresh water might change some of that.
Well, it did the last time we had a big freshwater push. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, you know, what the river's been doing, we had a freshwater push, and then you saw that freshwater push really declining, and the river levels were starting to go down quite a bit. And here they are, climbing right back up again. You know, we are at 1,300 cubic feet a second in Arcadia right now, which is up from 900 cubic feet a second just 2 days ago, and it's on an upwards trajectory. So we're going to see another freshwater push come down.
Right.
And all of the retention ponds, like along 776 and 775, they're all right up to the roadway now. It's been years since I've seen them have that much water in them. So all that water's got to go somewhere too.
Right. But the cool part, when the fresh water pushes out of the rivers, you know, like when it's pouring out of the Myakka River or out of Myakka Lake and starts pushing down, it pushes like your weaker swimmers down. Your tilapia, your armored catfish, Mayan cichlids even get pushed down because they're a little bit slower swimmers too. Same way on the Peace River, and what'll happen is you sometimes get these little fingerling / sub-adult tilapia schools that just get pushed down following the front wave of that heavy push of fresh water. And all the fish pick up on that somehow with their, you know, natural sixth sense. And they know to run up the rivers. So, like, even though it was a ghost town 2 days ago, in 2 days from now, there might be a massive amount of tarpon and snook going up there and feeding on all those schools of bait fish that are being pushed down to them.
Yeah.
And it can be pretty epic up there, especially on the Peace River, because I've seen it up there firsthand a few times. I've only heard about it on the Myakka, but I've never personally witnessed it.
And I've thought about this real hard for the last couple of years since we've talked about tilapia flushes. And I don't think that those fish are actually getting flushed down because they're weak swimmers, because tilapia really aren't weak swimmers. I think they're following it for the same reason that the other fish are swimming up current to meet it. Because
nutrients.
All those nutrients are going to cause a plankton bloom, and that plankton bloom is going to cause all kinds of other little bait fish and stuff. There's basically going to be a buffet.
Right.
And everybody is following to where the buffet is.
Yeah. One's good. One's coming from the top. The other one's coming from the bottom.
Yep. And I think you do get some of the weaker swimmers, the hoplos, the placostomus, stuff like that, which really are weak swimmers that get kind of pushed along with the current. But I don't think the tilapia are on that list. I think they're there on purpose.
That makes sense to me.
I don't think
they're
there to get
eaten. Because you see them schooled up in bunches.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, that would make pretty good sense.
Yeah. I just don't think they count on the snook and the tarpon being there to meet them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we're swimming into harm's way.
Oops.
Jumping out of the pan and right into the fire. Here we go. Yeah, but that's something to look forward to, you know, I think, because over the next several days, if you're, you know, because the tarpon have been out in the 20-foot holes on the southern part of the west wall, and then they've been moving throughout the day pattern from in the morning, starting out in the southern part of the west wall, bottom of the 20-foot holes, and then working their way up kind of towards the Myakka. And I think if you see where these fish all of a sudden play a disappearing act where they just aren't anywhere, time to run up above El Jobin or up above the 41 bridge and start looking for them as you're working your way up both rivers and see where they're at.
Yeah, I think this is the time to do river fishing. You know, if you've got red tide coming into the harbor and the Boca Grande Pass and places like that, it's probably a good time to do more freshwater work.
Yeah,
well, and
to
extent. I think that's what's really going to drive this, because we just had a freshwater flush.
Right.
And normally you get one. You don't usually get two.
Right.
But because we're having the second flush occurring as we have that red tide that's bottling fish up and preventing them from moving out into the Gulf, I think that there's a real good chance that we're going to see another one of those, you know, sudden kabooms of fishing up there. If we didn't have red tide out there, I would not be getting too excited about this second high water push.
No, I just think that this one's going to be a little bit more significant than when, what was that, tropical storm that pushed some of the water down. I think this has got far more water going on with this push than what the tropical storm did, don't you?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, we hit a flood stage up in Arcadia,
right,
with the storm.
Yeah,
so,
but that
we'll
was super, super localized, you know. I mean, there was
This water event is spread out across almost the entire state.
Well, yeah. No, I get that, but it spread out across the entire state, and so was Elsa. But the water that I'm most concerned with is what comes down the Peace and Myakka Rivers.
Right.
So if we hit flood stage then, I don't know if we'll hit flood stage with this one or not.
What are we at right now?
Well, like I said, we're at 1,300 cubic feet, which is, I mean, down from 1,600 cubic feet on the 29th. I guess I could change that to looking at the feet in height. Yeah, it's not that high. Flood stage is 11 feet, and we're standing at 5.5 right now.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what happens. It should be interesting over the next couple of days, you know, especially since this is going on still all the way up to Tampa versus yesterday was way above Tampa. Yeah, it's we'll see. It'll be interesting. See what happens. But if you want to go out there and chase tarpon now, I was getting phone calls all this morning. There were several guys out there this morning chasing them.
You can't fish for them this morning. It was raining.
They were fishing for them. I tried yesterday, but it was blowing way too hard. You know, but today they were hooking up this morning out there pretty well, and they're catching pretty much everything on bait busters. I know a lot of people want to do ladyfish, pinfish, stuff like that right now. But the biggest problem you're running into is that there's so many little sharks and catfish out there mixed in with it that your natural bait just isn't lasting long enough to make it worth the time and the aggravation. And especially since the ladyfish aren't schooled up in the harbor in real good numbers yet, because we're still a little early for that. they're having a hard time finding bait, so I'm not going to go out there and spend 2 hours looking for ladyfish for bait just to have it eaten off in 5 minutes from a shark or catfish.
Right. And well, let's apply critical thinking to this, okay?
We have to do that?
If the ladyfish have not shown up in large numbers, then the tarpon probably aren't eating what?
Ladyfish.
Right.
Imagine that.
Huh.
You know what's lacking out there, too, is the thread fins. The schools of thread fins have not been at all abundant this year.
So what are they eating?
I don't know. I honestly don't. Because, I mean, even if you're watching the bottom machine out there, you're not seeing threadies down deep. You're not seeing schools of bait down deep. And last year, the thready population was pretty horrible, too. So I'm really not sure what exactly they're feeding on, number one. But number two, how their pattern is going to be this year. You know, because last year there was only, what, maybe 2 weeks of ladyfish feeding going on with the tarpon?
If that.
Yeah.
It was pretty pathetic.
Yeah. So I'll be real curious to see what it does this, you know, this year. And people don't realize, for me, I pretty much will usually wager some pretty good money on that August and September tarpon fishing can be every bit as good or better than April-May fishing in Boca Grande for tarpon.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's...
Except it's a little warmer.
It's a lot warmer. But quality of fish, quantity of fish, less headache, less aggravation because you're dealing with far fewer people.
And even if everybody who fished Boca Grande Pass decided, hey, you know what, I'm going to fish this time of year too, they'd be spread out over such a bigger area that really wouldn't be that terrible.
Nope. You'd be getting mad at two guys instead of 20.
Right.
Yeah, I'll take that. You know, it's pretty awesome, but we'll see where it goes. The other thing that people have been starting to catch too the last several days, and I know you've been seeing it on the Fish and Frank's Fishing Club page.
Mm-hmm.
All the redfish that have been popping up on there this past week. Been seeing those?
I've been seeing a few redfish. Seeing a lot more black drum.
But. Well, yeah. Yeah. But the redfish have kind of perked up a little bit this past week compared to what it's been like in several weeks.
Well, I would definitely say that. If you want to compare this past week to the past month, yes, it's been a very noticeable increase.
Right. So if you want to go out there and try for some redfish, they are catching them mostly down in like Turtle Bay and Bull Bay. A few down in the intercoastal down there in Pine Island Sound. But you got to work at it.
Now, hold on a second, because you may be thinking, wait a minute, I thought Robert just told us a few minutes ago that down around the intercoastal is where the red tide was. So how is it that that's also where the redfish are?
Because they haven't moved out yet, because the red tide down south in the Pine Island area has not really been affected yet.
Right. And Bull and Turtle Bay, we haven't seen it really moving into those areas either.
No, and there's so much fresh water that usually comes out of through that whole Cape Hayes area that it does come into Bull and Turtle Bay, but very rarely, especially this time of year, as high as that fresh water content is. So it's going to take a pretty big push for that red tide to get up inside there personally.
Right. Now, all of this stuff, of course, is subject to change.
Oh, yeah. It's all hypothetical.
We didn't have red tide in Boca Bayou a couple of days ago. We might have told you to go in there and fish for the snook that had been pushed off the beach. Well, right now, that sounds like a pretty lousy plan.
Yeah.
So, you know, 3 days from now, you might have red tide moving up into Bull Bay, and it would be a lousy plan for you to go in there. So we're always keeping that in the back of our minds, but we're keeping it in the back.
You right. know,
that's not at the forefront. The forefront is I'm going to find healthy water. I'm going to find a clean area. I'm going to find some fish in it. And if you do run across an area where there's red tide and where there's dying fish and where you're coughing, just move. Move fish somewhere else.
Well, and this also reinforces the fact of everyone always has plan A in mind, and they just go right to that same spot that they have planned for, even though they went over a school of tarpon or a school of ladyfish or possibly a school of redfish or even black drum. They bypassed all that just to go to their same old spot. And this is a time of year where you got to be prepared to change your mind a lot, change your plans. You know, it may not be what you wanted, but this is what you've got to go with. And that's the best part about living here in this area is that, hey, I don't have to fish for snook today. I can go fish for tarpon. Or, hey, I don't want to fish for tarpon. I can go fish for little sharks. you can change your mind.
Right.
You know, you have that ability.
Even if you are still dead set on, I want to fish for snook and redfish. You know, if I go to Bull Bay or Wooden Creek and I discover, hey, you know what? It's not good here for whatever reason, red tide, lack of bait, whatever the reason might be. There's a lot of other places that you can move to. You know?
Absolutely.
And knowing those areas, knowing the waters is so key to being a well-rounded fisherman down here. You got so many people who only know one spot or maybe a little handful of spots, and that's all they've got. So if they go to those areas and they're wrecked for whatever reason, you know, the Pompano netters were out last night and there's no fish in your spot, there's three boats sitting in your area that you know, where are you going to go? You don't know any place else. You need to take some time and do some exploration.
Yeah. And be prepared to be a little frustrated because, what, August and September can be two of the most trying months in the harbor period for fishing for
sure.
The most part.
Absolutely.
You know, and one, like what we just talked about, it's all the rainfall. You know, people forget that that amount of fresh water coming out of the rivers, out of every canal system, totally changes everything. And that dark water is a solar panel. That solar panel makes it very hot. What's the Gulf temperature, like 86.5 or something like that?
I could look it up on my phone if I'd have known that you wanted me to. Mm-hmm. The last time I was personally out in the Gulf, we were 24 miles offshore, and it was 91 degrees at the surface.
Right.
So,
well, in some places, warm. Some places in the harbor are getting 94, 96 degrees in the canal systems and up by the 41 bridge.
And it helps that we have this overcast going on right now, that we had an overcast day most of yesterday, that we had an overcast day the day before. Mm-hmm. You know, all that helps to bring the temperatures down a little bit. But still, it's the sunshine state. It's going to pop back out. It's going to heat things up.
Well, it cools it down a little bit. It cools the surface temperature down a little bit, and it reoxygenates the water just a little bit, but it's a very temporary thing. It's not a long-term thing, you know, but that warm water does hold a lot less oxygen, and people forget that. So a lot of those fish run from that, you know, and then, of course, you also have this time of year, like we were talking about, some of those sulfuric smells that you'll find out there. What's that do? That can create hypoxia, right?
Yeah. When you smell that sulfur, what you're actually smelling is anaerobic decay. And anaerobic decay is areas where there is very little or no oxygen in the soil areas. But when that stuff starts bubbling up, it sucks the oxygen right out because there's still compounds that are going to be subject to aerobic decay that uses all the oxygen up pretty quickly. So you have areas where there's nothing to breathe. And if there's nothing to breathe, then nobody probably hangs out there.
Yeah. Or that's sometimes where you see some of the little fish gills. It'll be very isolated because it happens quickly.
We were talking today about sharks moving up into the canals to get away from the red tide.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like they've got another problem from the other end, is not enough oxygen in the water, or the water's too warm for them.
Yeah.
So that's going to be interesting to see how that works out.
They're going to blame it on something else. They'll blame it on sea COVID.
Probably. Yeah.
That'll be what it is. Because
it'll be sea COVID.
But catching a black tip in one of the canals is probably a hell of an event.
Oh, yeah. It's shocking to a lot of people when you cast out and you're expecting to fish for a catfish or something and have a black tip or a bull shark eat your bait.
Yep. Yeah. But the black tips are a little bit lower key when you see them up there because, again, they don't have their full oxygen ration and the water is warm, so they don't usually get the aerobatic routine that you get off. Mm-hmm. Out off the beach. It's more like fighting a bull shark.
Still fun, though.
Oh, definitely.
Definitely still fun. Now, talking about the sharks, what about all the little sharks that are out there?
What about them?
I don't know. We don't have Mike around to ask him.
Want
to
do the baby shark song? Is that what
No, definitely not.
It's all right. It's in somebody's head now, and that's enough for me.
Thanks. Should beat him with a stick. Now, you know, there is a lot of little sharks out there right now, and people can, you know, because we got a lot of our kids going back to school. We've still got quite a few visitors from up north coming down here doing their last-minute vacation before their kids go back to school. This is kind of that perfect time of year when you can go out and target these little sharks and have a really, really good time.
So what you really want to do if you're trying to catch those little sharks is not go fishing for little sharks. That's the kiss of death for your trip for little sharks. What you're going to do is you're going to go tarpon fishing. except instead of using the bait busters like Robert suggested earlier, you're going to use natural bait. You're going to use half a ladyfish or a dead thready hanging out there. Whether it's underneath the float or sitting on the bottom doesn't really seem to make much of a difference. But remember, and think real hard and focus all your energy on, we are tarpon fishing. And if you're tarpon fishing with those kinds of baits, then the little sharks will come up and they'll eat them. But if you're shark fishing with those little baits, then forget about it. All you're going to catch is catfish.
The fish gods are going to prove you wrong.
Yep. That's right, yeah.
They will poop on your day.
You dove enough. You know how that works. We're going to go looking for this.
I certainly do. The other thing that I would be using would be frozen sardines.
Yeah.
Yes. Something oily and nasty to be floating
on. Yeah, sardines, threadies, ladyfish, mullet, all that stuff. Great choices.
And I always take a lot of frozen bait with me when I go shark fishing because that way it almost guarantees me some fresher bait because it is nice to have some fresh bait while you're out there. But I'm not going to spend hours looking for fresh bait to fish for an hour for something that I could have had a lot more fun with having all that bait and chum with me.
Well, and like you said, the ladyfish have been a little hard to come by.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I know, but some people don't hear that and they still want to go out there and try it.
That's why I said, like you said, so I'd give them one more opportunity to hear it. So,
now, do you like using a chum bag when you're out there fishing for those little sharks?
We're not fishing for little sharks. We're fishing for tarpon, so no.
Do you like to use a chum bag to help attract those tarpon into you? You ever find that helps?
It's definitely not going to hurt you. Neither will a little drip of menhaden oil occasionally on the surface of the water. And by a little drip, sometimes more than a little drip, because a couple little drips are great. But what I really want to do is I want to convince those predatory fish that there has been a bait fish massacre up current of their position. So they will swim up towards it to investigate and hopefully find the baits that we have put out there for tarpon, not sharks.
Okay. Now, would you still be using a steel leader?
Well, since we're technically fishing for tarpon, that's going to be a hard call. You know, back in the olden days, it was very common to use steel leaders when fishing with dead baits for tarpon, especially when you were soaking those dead baits on the bottom. So we can still say that we are tarpon fishing if we're using steel leaders. So, yeah, I think we can get away with that.
Okay. Just kind of checking because you never know where that's going to go.
Right. Well, and if you really are tarpon fishing, you know, you probably wouldn't be using steel leaders. And it's surprising the number of sharks that you'll actually land on those mono or fluorocarbon leaders.
Yeah, that's true. Especially since you do have to technically use a circle hook for shark fishing.
Right.
Tarpon fishing, most people do use a circle hook, but it is not a legal requirement.
Right. But for sharks, it's a legal requirement and has been for a couple of years now.
Now, here's the other one, and this is going to have to branch off into some of the offshore stuff because a lot of people don't realize, you know, because we've got so many new people moving down here, circle hooks are a requirement when fishing any reef, right?
No.
Any reef species?
Yes. When you are targeting reef species, you have to use a circle hook. And the list of reef species does not include some things that you might think of as reef species, such as porgies and sheep's head. With grunts, those are reef species, and yet, you know, we don't have a circle hook requirement for them. And then you've got other species that you might not necessarily think would be reef fish, things like amberjack, triggerfish, hogfish. Those are reef species, but most people don't really think of them as reef fish.
But yeah,
think
those
of
are
and snook.
But
yeah,
that's required.
Yes, circle hooks are inline. Circle hooks are required for all those species.
Okay. Now, that would include fishing any reef inside of a bay, especially like, let's say, Charlotte Harbor.
So there's a lot of question about circle hooks and when they're actually required for targeting those species, and the answer is at all times. So let's say that we're fishing from the pier over in Inglewood, and we're fishing for the little mangrove snappers and the pinfish and the grunts and whatever else lives right below our feet. It's mostly fun fishing. And you happen to catch a 12-inch mangrove snapper on your J-hook. Well, you can release him, but you can't legally keep him because he wasn't caught on a circle hook. And they've changed that law, the wording of it, a couple times so that they tried to make it more clear and they only made it more obfuscated and harder to understand. But basically, any time that you are catching any fish that's on the reef species list, which is any snapper, any grouper, hogfish, triggerfish, amberjacks, that you have to use an inline circle hook to legally keep that fish.
Which is dumb.
Hey, I didn't write the law, okay?
It's just dumb.
They didn't consult me.
Does that make any sense to you, RJ?
They didn't ask me.
I can tell you that the purpose behind the circle hook supposedly was to make sure you got all jaw hooks, that you weren't gut hooking your fish, so it was easier to release them. I think that was the original theory behind it. Whether that worked out or not for anybody, I don't know.
Yeah, it's still – I understand that theory, but the way they wrote it is so poorly, horribly written. You know, while keeping your fish, you have to use a circle hook. But if you're just strictly catching and releasing them, you can use a J-hook. And
right. How does that work?
But that is basically – it exists because they didn't require circle hooks for all species, and that was the alternative. The alternative – because they know – when you put a bait in the water, you don't know what you're going to catch.
Right.
You know, I might be pitching white bait up against a shoreline for snook, but I'm catching mangrove snapper after mangrove snapper instead.
Right.
So, you know, you can legally use that J-hook for snook fishing, but you can't legally use it for mangrove snapper fishing. So if you accidentally were to catch a mangrove snapper while targeting something else and therefore not using a circle hook, you could release it. You weren't going to be in trouble for catching it on a J-hook.
Yeah.
Make sense?
Yeah. It's still dumb.
But here's the alternative. The alternative would be inline circle hooks required for all species at all times when using natural bait.
It would make it easier. It would definitely make the confusion a lot better.
It would make the confusion less, but it would also make certain species a lot harder to target.
Such as?
I have a real hard time catching sheephead on circle hooks.
Okay. I guess I could see that.
Yeah, most of the lipped fish, you're going to have trouble with a circle hook.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never tried. I mean, the circle hook that I use for sheep's head is actually offset. So just a J hook.
Well, there you have it.
It's just a funny bent J hook at that point.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, that is an interesting thought. But when you're talking about just sheep's head, it would only affect them for the most part with you.
Okay.
I'm sure it would be a whole lot of other people too.
How about the mackerels? Mackerel fishing with circle hooks?
Never tried. I mean, I've caught them as bycatch while out there,
right,
with circle hooks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it worked the same as any other time, but I couldn't tell you. I've never really actually specifically tried for them that way.
What about trolling natural baits with circle hooks?
Well, they do that for marlin and sailfish all over the world.
Right. But you're hooking those fish a little bit differently than what you're going
to
hook.
Well, then you'd have to hook it up differently.
Well, you hook those fish because they attack a bait a different way. A lot of those marlin and billfish that are attacking baits with circle hooks aren't necessarily hooked in the mouth because of the way that they feed. Mackerels don't feed that way. So your chances of actually hooking fish, if you required the use of circle hooks with all natural bait, would go down. So now you're making all kinds of other exceptions. So no matter how you try to write this law, it's going to get convoluted and difficult.
Right. Yeah, I guess so. It's still confusing to me and frustrating. I don't get it.
Well, the original concept, again, was it was easier to release from a circle hook than it was from a J-hook. And we're actually creating the exact opposite, that if you catch them on a J-hook, you got to release them.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
And
personally,
I've never...
I would have required a debarbed circle hook. Because, you know, circle hooks in general, yeah, they do usually hook the fish in the mouth. But I've seen some people just absolutely tear a fish up trying to get that hook back out.
Right. But even if it's debarbed, it's still a bear because that point's coming back to the shank and trying to rotate it around. The shank ends up wanting to hit him in the side of the face, trying to get enough past that bend to even just get to the point to pop it out.
So I debarb my circle hooks routinely. I knock them down to just a nub. And when we're reef fishing, if we're in shallow enough water that they don't have to be deflated, 95% of the fish that I release by just grabbing the circle hook with a pair of pliers and turning it upside down, and the fish just fall right off.
Okay. But you don't debarb the hook.
I knock it down to a nub just so that it will still hold the bait.
Okay. So it's not debarbing the hook. So barbless hooks would be a bad idea.
Well, a fully debarbed hook makes it more challenging for your bait to stay on.
Right.
So just having a nub makes it a little bit easier for
your bait
to stay. So just
rolling the barb, the point of the barb down, flatten it out of the way, just to have that bump there.
Yeah, I use VMCs, which have a high barb on them, so I actually flatten it down a little bit more than that.
Okay.
So literally, it's just a nub left on there, just enough to basically function as a bait holder. You know, it does make it more difficult with some reef species. Triggerfish, which just reopened, by the way, August 1st, are harder to catch on circle hooks. We do have that happen sometimes, but it is
especially
more difficult.
Especially if it's a world record.
Yeah. Giant.
He'll never
world
hear
record
that.
Released triggerfish. No.
Yeah.
He'll never
One
know.
Of our guys caught it. Definitely would have been a world record triggerfish.
Uh-huh.
And let it go. Never even took a picture of it, didn't think anything about it, and it was from what all of the people were saying that were on the boat, mm-hmm. it was twice the size or triple the size of any triggerfish they had ever seen.
Yeah.
Kind of funny.
I don't know what the excuse is for not taking a shot. You know?
For not taking a picture. Yeah. I don't get that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of your biggest.
Especially if it's something on. I mean, if you've just caught 7 triggerfish and they're all regular size, I mean, why are you taking a picture of every one of them, you know?
Right.
But when you pull something in that's unusual, very, very big, different color or something like that, take a picture of it.
Yeah.
It adds to our body of knowledge.
We don't see too many doormat triggerfish.
No, we don't.
You
know? Right.
But so, by the way, for those of you who don't know, 15 inches measured to the fork. For triggerfish, and your bag limit is 1 per person.
That's crazy.
1. Well, you can go fish the Atlantic if you want.
No.
Your bag limit's 10, and they only have to be 12 inches.
I don't want to go over there.
Okay.
I try to avoid that place if I can.
Well, then you get what you get.
Yeah.
Buddy.
Well, I don't go offshore very often either, so.
That's
true. So what's going on offshore? Well, we got a few minutes left here.
Triggerfish have been doing okay, but the big thing out there has been all the red grouper. You know, a lot of red grouper.
I've been seeing a lot of pictures of red grouper lately.
Yeah, 25 to 35 miles has been kind of the big number. This last week, red snapper closed, so there wasn't quite as many people running offshore as there had been. So a few less reports, but one guy was out, what's today? Today is
Thursday.
Thursday, so he was out Tuesday, I believe. He was going out with some friends offshore. They went out 38 miles. They got several king mackerel. They watch another guy out there who was trolling around get a few king mackerel. They got a whole lot of yellowtail snapper up to 22 inches long, but most of them were about 16 to 18 inches long. Mangrove snapper from 1.5 pounds to their biggest one, I think, was 4 pounds, he said. A couple of red grouper. They all caught their limit of red grouper, but no real giant ones, but just good fish. And then, of course, they got into the grunts and some of the lane snapper that were out there. But he was more excited about the kingfish that they had caught, several of them on the boat, and the yellowtail snapper. And that really did him good because this customer, he honestly hasn't been able to really fish for about the last year because of some health issues. And he's just now starting to feel good enough where this was his first trial going off that far offshore for more than an hour. So for him to come in and just have a smile from ear to ear talking about all these fish that they caught, just it made it worth
I would
worth
say
this
it would,
morning
yeah.
It was pretty awesome.
That is awesome.
So their next trip they're going to try next week, he's still not sure if he's going to be able to do it because they want to go out to about 60 miles, which turns it into a 12 to 15 hour day rather than an 8 hour day for him, and he's not sure. But he's still excited to think about it. It's pretty good stuff. So I know we only have a few minutes left, but we didn't talk about black drum, which is kind of literally the elephant in the room with the fish that are being caught out there right now.
I tried to talk about black drum, but you were all hung up on redfish.
I had to. It was a fish that needed to be talked about.
I understood, but I thought we were going to slide into the black drum then, and you just
nope. I squirreled on you. I had to pull a Frank at some point during the moment.
Okay, boys and girls, let's talk about black drum.
Excellent idea.
So all the black drum have been schooling up, and a lot of people have been catching them in the PGI canals, the Port Charlotte canals, El Jobin has been getting a few there. Not a ton, but definitely a few fish.
They're getting some big ones.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all in that 30 to 50-pound range.
I haven't seen any that I would say is under 20.
Yeah.
I mean, these are all mamma jamma fish.
Yeah. Not eating fish, but just fun fish to catch, you know. And I think the one thing that I am seeing that's always been pretty bad is the way people are handling them.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
You know, it's horrible how these people are handling these fish.
And they get no respect at all.
No.
And I don't understand why. I mean, here you are. You've brought up this fish. For a lot of people, it's going to be the biggest fish they've ever caught. You know? And then you see them grab it with a boga grip by the top lip a lot of times and then hold it out and up. And, you know, it is a terrible, terrible thing for that fish to be held like that. I mean, you're doing significant physical damage to those fish that you know you're going to release.
Right.
You know, and if it's the biggest thing you've ever caught, you know, I would think people would just show them a little bit more,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. You know, they just think, oh, it's just a black drum, no big deal.
I guess it's because we don't eat them.
I guess, but they treat tarpon a lot better.
Well, because we put tarpon on a pedestal.
Right.
We put tarpon on a pedestal a long time ago. But look how they treat jacks.
Yeah, well, jacks are the same way. Yeah, they treat them very horribly too, and yet those are some of the most epic fighting fish ever.
Right. It's literally the hardest fight you've ever had in your life. And what do? You sling it into the boat, you dangle it from a boga grip, you take a couple pictures, and then you just literally drop it back in the water.
Right.
It's just a trash fish. It's just a jack.
Yeah.
It's just a black drum.
Yeah. No, and it's pretty sad because we haven't had these black drum here in these numbers in honestly probably 20 years. Every year for the last probably about 5 years, we've been seeing the numbers go up, wouldn't you say?
And
5 to 6 years.
You might get into an area where, okay, there's a school of fish that's moved in and now we're catching a bunch of fish. But what you haven't had is them being so widespread and in so many places at once where people are catching them, where you're seeing all of these reports.
And so many of them are catching them on artificials too, because it's always been natural bait. Always, you know, it's been complete accident when you catch them on an artificial, but they're catching them on frozen blue crabs and shrimp. And it's amazing that's amazing by its own right. But with them, you know, I was catching them behind the house on DOA bait busters, the lure that I throw for tarpon fishing.
Right. And I think that's because we're seeing them in denser schools, and that denser school of fish is they're all competing for food. They're all looking for something to eat. So they're more willing to hit something that isn't what they exactly wanted.
So it's plan B and C again.
Exactly.
They didn't want this, but they had to have that.
Right. You go with what you got.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think the big thing is with these black drum is definitely treat them with a lot more respect. Handle them carefully. Don't hang them from a vertical position. Actually cradle their belly. You know, set them on your lap for a picture or whatever, and then set them back nicely in the water and resuscitate them and let them swim off for another day.
Some of the best handling I've seen of black drum is the guy took his net and he pressed the fish up against the side of the boat, using the net to hold him up against the side of the boat, and he just reached down with a needle nose plier and got the hook out, and that was the end of that.
Yeah.
And that's really how you should handle these fish. There really is no purpose to pick them up out of the water and lay them on your lap.
Right. I get it for the first one or for the biggest one to take that picture just to show the people back up north, hey, look at what we've got down here.
Right.
That's great. But then after that, yeah, you don't need a picture of every single one. You don't need to haul every one of those fish out of the water. You just don't.
Just like RJ was talking about earlier with the trigger fish.
Yeah.
You don't take a picture of every one of them that you catch, just that one.
Why not? The song already?
Yeah. It is.
That is the song already. So anyway, this is Robert from Fish and Franks. Captain Josh Olive.
The Fish Coach. That's fishcoach.net.
And RJ here at WKDW in Northport. Thank you for everything. Appreciate it.
It's good to be back.
Glad you're back.